This is VOA News. Reporting by remote, I'm David Byrd. President Joe Biden has outlined his plan to make all adult Americans eligible for vaccination by May 1st and get the country back closer to normal by the 4th of July. In his first primetime address to the nation since becoming president, Biden said of the coronavirus, which has killed more than 530,000 Americans and disrupted the lives of countless more, "It was different for everyone, but we had all lost something." But the president said there are reasons for hope. He said he will direct all states to make all American adults eligible for vaccination by May 1st. Biden also appealed to Americans to do their part to prevent another surge in infections and death.
If we do all this, if we do our part, if we do this together, by July the 4th, there's a good chance you, your families and friends will be able to get together in your backyard or in your neighborhood and have a cookout and a barbecue and celebrate Independence Day.
The president said Americans have faced a tough time, but repeated his belief that there's nothing the country cannot do if we work together. The number of Americans seeking unemployment benefits fell last week to 712,000, the lowest total since early November. Evidence that fewer employers are cutting jobs amid a decline in confirmed coronavirus cases and signs of an improving economy. The Labor Department said Thursday that applications for unemployment aid dropped by 42,000 from 754,000 the week before. Though the job market has been slowly strengthening, many businesses remain under pressure, and 9.6 million jobs remain lost to the pandemic that flattened the economy 12 months ago. Find more at our website, voanews.com. This is VOA News. A federal judge has ruled the U.S. Centers for Disease Control did not have the authority to issue a rental eviction moratorium. AP's Mike Gracia has more.
A federal judge in Ohio has ruled the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention didn't have the authority to issue a nationwide moratorium on rental evictions last year. In his ruling, U.S. District Judge J. Philip Calabrese said the CDC went beyond what the Federal Public Health Service Act allows. It was the second such ruling in less than a month. In late February, U.S. District Judge J. Campbell Barker in the Eastern District of Texas ruled the moratorium was unconstitutional. The Justice Department is appealing Barker's order. The CDC eviction moratorium was signed by President Donald Trump in September. President Joe Biden extended the moratorium through March 31st. I'm Mike Gracia.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo is now facing calls to resign from a majority of state lawmakers, while Albany police might launch an investigation into an allegation of sexual contact. AP's Jackie Quinn reports.
Five women made claims of inappropriate behavior against Governor Andrew Cuomo, but the sixth, an aide who says he groped her last year, has tipped the scales for some lawmakers, including Assemblywoman Patricia Fahey, a Democrat.
Cost me sleep last night. This latest one is a new level.
At least 121 members of the state assembly and Senate, more than half, according to an AP tally, have said Cuomo can no longer govern and should quit office now. Fahey says it's hard because of his leadership during the pandemic.
It is tough.
Cuomo denies touching anyone, but his acting counsel says she reported the groping allegation to Albany police as a matter of state policy. I'm Jackie Quinn.
Myanmar's military junta accused deposed leader Aung San Suu Kyi of corruption on Thursday and defended their handling of anti-coup protests. But as Reuters' Lucy Fielder reports, at least eight people were killed when the army opened fire on demonstrators.
Spokesman Brigadier General Zaw Min Tun said Suu Kyi took payments worth $600,000, as well as gold, while in government. According to complaints made by a former minister, that an anti-corruption committee is investigating. He also said security forces only used force when necessary against demonstrators. But eight people were killed when they opened fire on anti-coup protesters again on Thursday. Thursday's deaths add to a toll of more than 60 demonstrators killed since the coup of February 1st. On Wednesday, Amnesty International accused the military of adopting battle tactics and using lethal force against demonstrators.
That's Reuters' Lucy Fielder. Visit voanews.com for more. Reporting by remote, I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganya in Washington, in for James Batty. Today is Friday, March the 12th, and here are some of the stories we are covering for you this morning. Four high-profile Ethiopian political prisoners ended their almost 40-day hunger strike. Their lawyer says that they called off the hunger strike after pleas from elders and other notable personalities in the country.
Currently, they are in the hospital, not in jail. That means under the custody or monitoring of the prison administration. They are in the hospital. Their health have been deteriorated.
Ibsas Gemeda is the lawyer representing Oromo politicians Jawar Mohammed and Bekele Gerba. And in Senegal, activists and authorities alike have called for a national day of mourning today, Friday, March 12th, after 10 people were reportedly killed during recent protests in the country. And questions still remain about the whereabouts of Tanzanian President John Pombe Magufuli after reports that he may be hospitalized with COVID-19 at a hospital in Nairobi or in India.
It has taken him going down with COVID-19 for Tanzanians to know that all these concoctions that the president has been peddling in recent months are of no effect, and the president himself and his people do not have faith in them at all. That's why they took him to Kenya.
That is Tanzanian opposition leader Tundu Lissu speaking from Belgium. And Kenya is marking the first anniversary of COVID-19 at the time when health experts say that the country is battling a third wave of the COVID-19 pandemic. We have those stories plus sports coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. And let's start off in Ethiopia, where high-profile political prisoners ended their 39-day hunger strike after what their lawyer says was a plea from their elders and other notable personalities in the country. The prisoners, including notable Oromo politicians Jawar Mohammed and Bekele Gerba, had refused to eat until the Ethiopian government released all Oromo political prisoners. The prisoners also called on authorities to allow the reopening of political party offices in Oromia. Jawar Mohammed and Bekele Gerba are among 22 individuals who were arrested in relation to a wave of ethnic unrest that followed the murder of popular musician Hachalu Hundessa in June of 2020. They faced charges including conspiring to dismantle the constitution by force and other terror-related offenses. Their lawyer Ibsa Gemeda tells me that his clients believe that the charges are politically motivated.
Currently, they are in the hospital, not in jail. That means under the custody or monitoring of the prison administration. They are in the hospital. Their health have been deteriorated. Doctors also saying that they lost 15 kilogram weight each. They are recovering now.
Okay, so they're recovering right now in the hospital. Can you explain to us, for our listeners, who just give us a little context and background on the purpose of their hunger strike, and have they achieved their purpose now that they ended the hunger strike?
As we all know, they are in jail since June 30, 2020. That is for more than 7 months. Our clients believe that the charges are politically motivated, and they believe that the charges brought against them because to hinder them from the election or to get them out of the whole political process in Ethiopia. Our clients are members and high rank officials of Oromo Federalist Congress, and others are also members, high rank officials of Oromo Liberation Front. So they believe that they are technically driven out of politics and the election to be conducted in the few coming months. So they were opposing and they were accusing a government that the charges are politically motivated. They were asking that the release of all political prisoners. Most of them are Oromo political prisoners. They were also requesting the opening of political party offices. We know that more than 190 political parties' offices are closed across Oromia, the largest state in Ethiopian Federation. And the third demand of the hunger strike is the end of mistreatment of their families at prison and elsewhere.
So would you say would you say that the condition these conditions have been met by the government now that the prisoners have decided to end their hunger strike?
Generally, we can say that the conditions are not met, especially the first two conditions, the release of all Oromo political prisoners and also other political prisoners. Of course, there are some prisoners who are released. The Yellow Movement prisoners were wearing yellow clothing in solidarity of the Jawar Mohammed Ital, who are in yellow uniforms of the prison administration. And also there was another minor purpose or demand of the prisoners. That was the moving of Colonel Gamachu Ayana from unsafe prison cell to the safer prison cell. This was met, and the other major demands are not met. However, the Oromo elders and notable personalities were requesting so many times to end the hunger strike.
What is the government charging them with, and when do you expect them to appear in court next?
The government is accusing them of inciting civil war and a preparation of terrorism too, and also bearing illegal arms, and the additional one to specifically to Jawar Mohammed's case is telecom fraud. As it is opposed by defense lawyers' objection, the court dropped the bearing of illegal arms charge, and it is continuing with the three other major charges. These charges are politically motivated, they believe, our clients believe, and they are going to appear before court on March 15, 2021.
That was Ipsa Kemeda, the lawyer representing Oromo political prisoners, including Jawar Mohammed and Bekere Gerba. I reached him in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. Tanzania's main opposition leader, Tundu Lissu, says that he has information from reliable sources that President John Magufuli was in a hospital out of the country suffering from COVID-19. He says that he has information that Magufuli was later airlifted to India for treatment. All attempts to get Tanzanian government officials to comment on this claim were fruitless. Reuters reported that Kenya's foreign ministry and Nairobi hospital both say that they had no information to disclose, but Kenya's national newspaper cited unidentified political and diplomatic sources saying that an African leader that it did not name was being treated for COVID-19 on a ventilator at a Nairobi hospital. President Magufuli has been a denier of COVID-19, telling Tanzanians to put their trust in prayer and homemade treatments. He was last seen in public on February 27. Mr. Lissu denies that he was being political about President Magufuli's health. He tells VOA's Jamsbati that if Tanzanians do not believe his claim, then they should answer these questions. Where is the president and what is the state of his health?
My latest information tells me that they are planning to sneak him out to India because Kenya is too close to Tanzania, apparently, and they do not want the embarrassment. Should it come to the worst, they do not want the embarrassment of having to get him back to Tanzania from Kenya.
I think, you know, these days, because of COVID-19, especially when the Tanzanian president is a skeptic of COVID-19, so anytime someone, like an official, gets sick, especially the Zanzibar first vice president died recently, the first thought that comes to people is that is the person sick of COVID-19. What do you know?
Well, from what I hear, all these recent deaths are COVID-19 deaths. The first vice president of Zanzibar, Magufuli's own chief secretary, and the very senior officials in the government, in academia, you know, very high profile Tanzanians have died recently, and these are all deaths associated with COVID-19 complications. And the president himself is in Nairobi because of complications arising from COVID-19. So it has taken him going down with COVID-19 for Tanzanians to know that all these concoctions that the president has been peddling in recent months are of no effect, and the president himself and his people do not have faith in them at all. That's why they took him to Kenya.
So can you tell us, how do you know the whereabouts of the president?
Well, I have information from three highly placed sources in Nairobi, including at the Nairobi hospital where I stayed for 4 months after the attempted assassination of September 2017. I have sources from within the Kenyan intelligence, and I have the third source who is very close to powerful people in Nairobi, and all these three different sources have told me he is at the Nairobi hospital.
Now, what do you say to, say, supporters of President Magufuli who might think that you, say, I wouldn't say happy about his situation, but, or that you are being political?
Whoever thinks that I'm being political should be able to answer these questions. Where is the president because he has not been seen in public since February 24th? And this is a president who doesn't go missing for 2 days, but he has been out of sight for over 2 weeks now. And there are rumors all over the place, and they are being reported in the international press. They cannot be reported inside Tanzania for reasons that there is no media freedom, but they are being reported outside Tanzania. There are rumors swelling on the social media that the president is very sick with COVID-19. He has had a cardiac arrest. He's in Nairobi. So if I'm being political, then they should answer these questions. Where is the president and what is his state of health?
Mr. Lissu, it's always a pleasure to speak with you, sir.
Thank you so much, Mr. Bharti.
That is Tundu Lissu, the presidential candidate of Tanzania's main opposition Chadema party. He was speaking to VOA's James Bharti from TNN, Belgium. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. In Malawi, the country's president, Lazarus Chakwera, received the first shot of the AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine Thursday during the launch of a vaccination program in the country. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
In a televised address at Zomba COVID-19 Field Hospital, President Chakwera commended the vaccine despite widespread public concern over its safety and efficacy.
AstraZeneca has been found by our scientists to be safe, effective, and suitable. In fact, as a show of good faith, I and others on this platform have volunteered to be the first to be vaccinated so that you can see that the vaccine is safe.
Chakwera said the vaccination program is a must-have for Malawi because of the damage COVID-19 has caused to the country. Malawi started the war against COVID-19 in March last year when a state of national disaster was first declared across the country because of the pandemic.
Since then, the pandemic has robbed us of our freedoms, shut down our businesses, destroyed our jobs, disrupted our travel, distorted our communal life, and destabilized our institutions.
Chakwera said most painful is that coronavirus, which causes COVID-19, has infected over 32,000 people, with 177 others dead, and 82% of them died during the second wave, which began in November. However, President Chakwera thanked healthcare workers for their efforts in combating the pandemic.
And it is fitting that 60,000 of them will be among the first to receive the vaccine during the first phase of this program.
Malawi is expected to receive 1.4 million doses of AstraZeneca vaccines through the COVAX initiative. Between March and May, Malawi will also receive 50,000 doses from India and 100,000 doses from African Union. With these consignments, Malawi is expected to vaccinate about 4 million people in its first phase of vaccination program. Health Minister Kumbize Kandodo Chiponda encouraged Malawians to get vaccinated.
Our plea is that the vaccine is not mandatory, it is a voluntary. Oh, please, we appeal to you, come and get this vaccine. We are going to do it in stages. But at the end of the day, we want at least 60% of Malawians, they should get this vaccine.
Kandodo Chiponda said Malawians should, however, continue to observe all measures against the pandemic, like washing hands with soap, observing social distance, and to put on face coverings. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
And let's go to East Africa in Kenya, where the country is marking exactly 1 year since the first COVID case was reported in the country. Kenya, just like any other country in the world, has experienced a lot of challenges due to the COVID-19 pandemic. And as Atieno Odhiambo reports from Nairobi, this comes at a time when experts say that the country is experiencing the third wave of the pandemic as the rollout of vaccines for frontline workers is ongoing.
Kenya is marking the first anniversary of COVID-19 today. This comes at a time when the country is officially battling the third wave of the COVID-19 pandemic. Government spokesperson Sarah Soguna, a survivor of COVID-19, describes his ordeal with the deadly virus. He says more than 7 months later, he is still dealing with residual symptoms of the disease.
The first week and the second week were really, really bad. But after the second week now, there was some good progress, and I was eventually let to go after 28 days in hospital. Not because I was feeling much better, but simply because I had tested negative, and therefore to limit the possibility of cross-infection. From the time I was discharged until today, it's about 7 or so months, and I'm still not being able to smell everything. You know, bads have come back, but in the sense of smell, not everything. So the smell has to be very strong for me to be able to pick it up.
Health Cabinet Secretary Mutahi Kagwe is warning that the situation could get worse after the positivity rate shot to 14%, the highest since last year. The number of deaths recorded this month have also increased. Kagwe adds that the new wave appears deadlier than the previous ones, as patients being hospitalized are presenting more severe symptoms.
I want to make it official today and to say that Kenya is already in a third wave. Positivity rate that we are announcing at about 14% is also the highest one since the last phase is sometime in November. We have seen an increase in numbers of those who are on ventilators. We have seen an increase in number on those who need oxygen. And therefore, we must continue with vigilance to ensure that these cases do not overrun our healthcare system.
Last week, Wednesday, Kenya received 1.02 million doses of Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine in the first consignment. Yesterday, it received 100,000 more doses from the government of India. The vaccination drive for frontline health workers was officially rolled out last week, Friday, and yesterday, it was officially launched for teachers. The drive will target Kenya's 500,000 teachers, starting with teachers aged 58 and above in the first phase. Teachers Service Commission Chief Executive Officer Dr. Nancy Masharia was the first to receive the vaccine and lauded the government for including teachers in the priority list.
The government has made the right decision to protect over 330,671 teachers working in public schools and 158,000 teachers working in private schools. The government has considered all these teachers, both in private and public, and they will be vaccinated since they are attending to children. This vaccination will go a long way to give us comfort that our over 15,000 teachers aged 58 and above will get protection from the COVID-19.
Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta is expected to address the country today on the new COVID-19 containment measures. The current ones include mandatory wearing of face masks in public places, ban of political gatherings, and dusk to dawn curfew, which most Kenyans hope will be lifted. The total viral caseload now stands at 111,185, with 1,899 fatalities. The latest victim is opposition leader Raila Odinga, who tested positive for COVID-19 last night. However, his doctor says he's responding well to treatment at Nairobi Hospital. Atieno Odhiambo, VOA Daybreak Africa, in Nairobi, Kenya.
And it's time for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, Jackson. We begin the sports with the CAF presidential elections, where South African billionaire mining magnate Patrice Motsepe is expected to be declared as the new president of the Confederation of African Football as he looks set to stand unopposed at today's General Assembly in the Moroccan capital, Rabat. Ivorian Jack Anoma, Senegal's Augustin Senghor, and Mauritanian Ahmed Yahia were previously in the running for the top job until FIFA President Gianni Infantino brokered a deal. The trio opted to withdraw and support Motsepe's candidacy after a deal was struck in Rabat on March the 7th. Kalusha Bwalya is former Zambia Football Association president.
Patrice has come to come in with to refocus and revive African football. So this is very, very important. So let us, make a line on the ground and say we're starting from here. We have a seasoned leader.
But not all countries' football association presidents on the continent are in support of the role FIFA played in ensuring that Patrice Motsepe contests unopposed. One such person is Musa Bellitti, the Liberian Football Association president. He spoke to my colleague James Barton on why he differed with his colleagues on Gianni Infantino's intervention in the election of the CAF president.
What do you mean when you say that FIFA fronted capitulation of CAF presidential candidates? What exactly do you mean?
They fronted because they organized it. They organized a meeting and they forced the other three candidates to give up because they blackmailed them. You know, that's what they're specialized in. That's what they always do. They blackmail them and force them out of the race in order for one candidate to remain in the race.
Do you think the other candidates, most of whom are, I think, from West Africa, have been shortchanged? Or can we say that FIFA went for the most qualified candidate, Motsepe?
FIFA did not go for the most qualified candidate. They are looking for the candidate they can use. Motsepe would have won the election, but he would have won with his own vote. And that would put FIFA in a difficult position because it means that he wouldn't have been beholden onto them. So to make Motsepe to feel that he is their candidate, they made him that the only way to do that is to make the man not to face competition. This is well planned and laid out by FIFA.
In athletics, the Department of Sports in South Africa has pledged over $800,000 to help Olympian Caster Semenya appeal her testosterone ruling. The confirmation comes on the back of Athletics South Africa's request for the department to make financial resources available for Caster Semenya to possibly return to her number one sports. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson, and have a great weekend. And that's it for this Friday, March the 12th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again Monday for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very great weekend, Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.